Peter B. Collins, News and Comment, here on Monday, April 8, 2013. American cowboys ride drones these days. Take it away,
Johnny. Cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged skies and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky. For he saw the riders coming hard and he heard their mournful cry.
It was one of those bolts of thunder.
Yippee-i-oh.
Came out of the sky in 2004. The first American drone strike in Pakistan took out an anti-Pakistani leader named Nek Muhammad. And this was the origin of the sordid deal, where Pakistan said, in exchange for taking out one of our enemies, who was not an Al-Qaeda leader, not a member of the Taliban aligned against the United States, we'll let you fly drones over Pakistan, and where we can, we'll pretend that we made those attacks, and where we can't, we'll just ignore America's violations of the sovereignty of the nation of Pakistan. And partial credit to the New York Times. In their Sunday edition, a front-page story goes into great detail about this secret bloody deal. They even say a secret deal on drones sealed in blood. CIA air war in Pakistan began with quid pro quo killing of rebel. Now, I can only give partial credit to the Times, because once again, they are reporting an important story, probably over the objections of the Obama White House, because one of their star reporters is about to publish a book. This is how we found out about the domestic surveillance program. The warrantless wiretaps that clearly violate our Fourth Amendment protections. Because James Risen, a star reporter on national security at the Times, was about to publish a book. The Times sat on the story. They had it before the 2004 elections, but didn't share it with the American people because the White House asked them not to. And so I recommend this important story, byline Mark Mazzetti. And I will get and read his new book, and if I'm interested, I'll invite him here for an interview. This is information we should have known about a long time ago. And it sets up the pattern that was expanded by Barack Obama to the point where, we were conducting almost daily killer drone strikes over the nation of Pakistan. And today, the Times followed up with a story that's bylined by Scott Shane, but at the end of it, it says, additional reporting provided by Mark Mazzetti. And again, critical issues about the Obama White House and its targeted killing program, what they call the kill or capture program. They say that they only kill people when it's not feasible to capture them. And Scott Shane goes to some length here to explain the various kinds of objection directed at the White House regarding America's killer capture program. Also, these drone strikes are not popular outside the United States. In a recent poll last year, 17% of Pakistanis support them against leaders of extremist groups. Now, from the right, Obama is attacked by Republicans in Congress for adopting a de facto kill preference because he shut down the CIA's overseas prisons and doesn't want to send more detainees to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But Americans are almost at the opposite end of that opinion spectrum. 65% of Americans in a Gallup poll last month approve of these drone strikes to kill suspected foreign terrorists. They're not concerned about the rule of law or any process. Only 28% opposed. And this article starts off with the recent case of Suleiman Abu Ghaith, a son-in-law of Osama bin Laden. And the precedents were shattered because he was taken into custody and not shipped to Guantanamo. He was sent to the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York City. And instead of a kangaroo court military commission trial at Gitmo, he was arraigned in federal district court in Manhattan. And compare that to the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, whom we were told was an active decision maker in al-Qaeda. We've yet to see any proof of that, but that's what we've been told. And his targeted killing in September 2011 by a drone strike in Yemen has been widely rationalized. And then there's a separate case of a man named Adnan al-Qadi, a well-connected Qaeda supporter living in Yemen, in the capital city of Sana'a. And the United States used a drone strike in 2012 that killed him. And the Times accurately reports neighbors told reporters that he could easily have been captured. And these are really important questions. They're not trivial issues of bad guys who've been dispatched. It's about how our country operates. What authority does the president have to put somebody on a list and order them to be killed? And why do people buy into the fiction that it's a killer capture program when bin Laden's son-in-law is about the only one recently who's been captured alive? Well, again, I appreciate that the Times is covering these issues, but I wish they would do it in a more timely manner and with a little better motivation. Buried in Friday's New York Times, a story from Italy, and we've been following the abduction of Abu Omar from the streets of Milan, the conviction in absentia of 26 Americans, mostly CIA operatives, and how the movie Zero Dark Thirty, as it became an infomercial for the CIA, talked about pivotal events and some of the ups and downs of the effort to find bin Laden, but didn't mention the Al-Masri case. He's the German who was picked up on a mistaken identity case, tortured. And this is a black mark on American actions in pursuit of the so-called war on terror. And later this week, we'll release an interview with Frank Viviano. He spent many years writing for the San Francisco Chronicle, was their foreign correspondent based in Europe for many years. He now lives in Italy, and he offers us some very interesting perspectives on how Italians feel about their own Berlusconi, who's still in the picture there and may be the next prime minister, and about our CIA and the hijinks on the streets of Milan. The talks in Kazakhstan between a representative of six world powers and the nation of Iran over its nuclear intentions came to a close at the end of the week. No agreement reached, no plans for new meetings. And I don't pretend to know where this will go from now, but it leaves unresolved the issues that keep building tensions in the West as Israel calls for a preemptive strike on Iran. We'll keep watching that picture for you here. In Afghanistan, the deadliest day for American personnel in recent months, militants killed six Americans, including a 25-year-old female American diplomat. in a pair of attacks, the most deadly day for the United States in the past 8 months. And as I mentioned last week, my concern is that this situation will deteriorate to the point where we end up running out of Afghanistan, or like we did in Saigon, having to airlift people out by helicopter. And that's a pretty ugly prospect. Back here stateside, another great report in the Sunday New York Times about the powerful chair of the Senate Budget Committee, Max Baucus. It's actually called the Finance Committee. And it reports that 28 former staffers of Senator Baucus, who's been in Congress virtually all his life, now work as lobbyists and get paid big bucks to get Max Baucus to insert special legislation that favors their clients. Max Baucus is up for re-election this year, and we have a number of listeners in the big sky state of Montana. And I would welcome your comments, because I've never met the man, but I still have a great deal of attitude toward him for his management of the so-called debate over health care reform and the way that he consistently squeezed out any discussion of single payer, public option, expansion of Medicare, all of which would have been much better than the package that ultimately surfaced. And it's his link to campaign contributors that once again raise questions about his fitness to serve and whether he truly represents the people of Montana or those who pay for his election campaigns. A story that we covered, oh gosh, a month or 6 weeks ago, was also in the Sunday Times. And it's called the Ag Gag Laws. And I give the Times credit for recognizing the importance of this story. What's happening is, repeatedly, we have seen cases of animal cruelty and other violations of the law where animal rights activists get a job on a farm, bring their video camera, capture these events, and then report them. And so, instead of dealing with the issues exposed, various state legislatures have passed laws that highly restrict the use of video cameras on farms. And I think this is really bizarre. The idea that you can limit free speech on a factory farm to protect the interests of corporate agriculture, it's just fundamentally wrong. And here is how the Times politely states it. Some of the legislation appears to be inspired by the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC. Well, it doesn't appear to be inspired. It's copycat legislation. The so-called model bills of ALEC. They just pop up like, oh, wild mushrooms in legislatures all over the country. And this ag gag is an especially pernicious form of putting limits on free speech in order to protect economic interests. And it is heightened by the bad law that Congress passed 8-9 years ago that took crimes like vandalism or arson or take your pick, various tactics used by animal rights organizations, and made them crimes subject to penalties that are multiple those of somebody who commits arson or vandalism not related to animal rights issues. And I've told you this one or two times before, but I really respect Congresswoman Maxine Waters of Los Angeles, because in an interview with her, I asked her about this homegrown terrorism law, and she actually admitted that she regretted her vote in favor of it. She said, "I got that one wrong." That's so refreshing. And we need to see more of that. And whether Alec is responsible for these moves or not, we're seeing across the country state-level restrictions on access to abortion. They don't explicitly ban abortion. They just pass limits on the right to choose an abortion to make it virtually impossible. The latest state is Kansas. And they sent Senator Sam Brownback, Governor Sam Brownback, a former senator, and in any case, quite a Neanderthal Republican, a bill that declares that life begins at fertilization. Now, this is a new stretch of religious dogma being interjected into science and public policy. As you probably know, your sense of human biology is better than some of these Republicans. Fertilization does not necessarily produce conception. Conception does not necessarily produce a fetus. And this hysterical approach to ratcheting up the laws to limit abortion, driven by religious ideology, is truly frightening to me. And in Kansas, the lower house of the legislature voted 90-30 for the bill after the Senate approved it 28-10. And not only do they try to redefine when life begins in a way that has tremendous implications, they have also passed other anti-abortion measures into law. The number of abortions in the state has dropped 11%, and they probably think that's a good thing. Now, I don't like to use statistics on an issue like this, but what it shows is that they are having a measurable effect in reducing access to choice, and that's a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution. On Friday, we reported to you about the courageous judge in Eastern New York, Edward Corman, who wrote an opinion saying that the Plan B morning after contraceptive pill, it's not an abortion pill, it's a contraceptive pill that can be used after intercourse. He ruled that it must be offered over the counter with no age restrictions. And now that I've had a chance to read through part of his ruling and some of the other coverage, this is truly remarkable, and it shows the political cowardice of the Obama administration, as the president allowed the Health and Human Services Secretary, Kathleen Sebelius, to impose a political judgment over a scientific-based ruling. You know, just like Bush did. And it's because this was in late 2011, we're approaching the re-election cycle, and it would have been inconvenient for the president to face the Roman Catholics, the Rick Santorums, and others on the Republican right who were challenging access to contraception as some sort of a moral imposition. Nobody's ever forced anybody to use contraception. It's voluntary. Well, let me take that back. There have been a few cases where courts have ordered women to use Norplant. But, you know, to have an insurance plan cover contraception for women, and in this case, to make a morning after pill, which is, according to science, safe, to restrict its access for political reasons, Judge Corman, an appointee of Ronald Reagan, deserves a lot of credit. He got it right. And let's bitch and moan about the airlines for a moment, shall we? Because we're going to be in good company. The complaints about flying on commercial airliners have grown exponentially. The rate at which passengers with tickets were denied seats because planes were full rose to 0.97 denials per 10,000 passengers, up from 0.78 in 2011. And they've put more seats on planes with less leg room and less side-to-side room. We're being squished in more than ever before. United Airlines had the highest consumer complaint rate of the 14 airlines with 4.24 complaints per 100,000 passengers. Southwest had the lowest at 0.25. Well, the answer is we've got to start complaining more, because it's really unpleasant to fly anymore. The whole experience from the time you get groped at the TSA to the point where you try to stuff your bags into the already crowded overhead compartment. And, of course, to pay $25 or $35 a bag and then have them lose your bag. The food's a little better, but you got to pay for it. It's just downright ugly out there, and we got to stand up and complain about it. Of course, if we do, the pilot might land the plane and have the police escort you off. Thanks for listening. I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.